Hey, my name is Liam Miller, and this is Love, Rinse, Repeat. Welcome to Love, Rinse, Repeat, another episode. I am Liam Miller, your host. I'm joined today right next to me by the baby Shoshana, who may be a slightly vocal host from time to time. We'll see how it goes. This episode today is another From the Vault episode, an interview I recorded last year with Mark G. Brett, who's down at Whitley College in Melbourne. You can hear Shosh. Get excited for Mark Brett. She's just pumping us all up. I dig it. I'm happy for it. Today, we talk with Mark about his book, Political Trauma and Healing, Biblical Ethics for a Post-Colonial World, which came out last year. It's got endorsements by Walter Brueggemann, by M. Daniel Carroll. So Mark is the Professor of Old Testament at Whitley College at the University of Divinity in Melbourne. He also authored Decolonizing God, The Bible and the Tides of Empire, and Genesis, Procreation, and the Politics of Identity. This is a really excellent book, talking back about political trauma and healing, as you'll hear from the interview. But we'll get all to that in a second. I'm really thankful again, especially for those who shared around the Jonathan Braylock episode, and perhaps you're tuning in. This is your second episode. Maybe you found us through that. Welcome along. I hope you find this conversation equally thrilling as we talk, about a whole bunch of post-colonial issues with Mark Brett. So there might be, I think, like a couple of references to conferences that are coming up toward the end of the interview that might be a little dated, so you can ignore that. But what you don't want to ignore is that in under 2 months now, if you're in Sydney, you should look out for the weekend that I'm kind of helping to host through the Uniting Church Chaplaincy at Macquarie University, which is Political Popularism and a Theological Response with John Flett, who is also a associate professor down in Melbourne as part of the University of Divinity, though he is with Pilgrim Theological College. That's November 3, 4, and 5. And hosted at Epping Uniting Church, so you can check that out if you Google it, or I'll put some info in the show notes. Anyway, thanks again for tuning in. Shoshi is attempting to roll from her front to her back, which is not quite a skill she has got yet. Keep going, Shosh. Do it for the people. Do it live on air. Welcome to Love, Rinse, Repeat. Mark, come on in. Come on in from the green room. Take a seat next to Shosh, and I should have also mentioned the dog Zeus is also sleeping over in the corner. Recording podcast interviews is a bit different these days, but it's equally fun. So anyway, here it is, the interview with Mark G. Brett, Political Trauma and Healing. Mark, welcome to Love, Rinse, Repeat.
Hey everyone, welcome to another interview. Liam here with another Australian guest for a change. I have Mark Brett, he's coming to us from down in Melbourne. Mark, welcome along.
Good to be with you.
For those who don't know, Mark Brett is a Professor of Old Testament or Professor of Hebrew Bible and Research Coordinator at Whitley College, part of the University of Divinity. He is the author of Biblical Criticism in Crisis, Genesis, Procreation and the Politics of Identity, Decolonizing God, the Bible and the Tides of Empire. He is the editor of Ethnicity and the Bible. And today we're talking primarily about his new work from 2016, Political Trauma and Healing, Biblical Ethics for a Post-Colonial World, which came out in 2016 through Erdmans and is fantastic. So that's a bit about you, Mark, professionally and rightly. What else do we need to know about you before we get started?
Oh, probably that I was brought up in Papua New Guinea, so that gives me a bit of a different perspective, I think, to most Anglo-Australians. So that was my home country. So coming to terms with being an Australian was a long and complex process.
Yeah, great. Thank you for that. I'm excited to get into how that experience and that theology and culture coming together influences your work. So that'd be really fun to explore. Now, people who watch our interviews know that sometimes what we like to do with some of our guests to help wade into their work, for those who have not encountered it before, is do a little conceptual rapid fire. It's my own little, TV game show that I like to play. Either this is for those who have never heard the term before, or maybe you've heard the term and you're using it on a semi-regular basis, but you're actually not entirely certain what it means, but it's too late to ask, which is usually my situation. So what I'm going to ask you is, I'm going to say a term, and what I'm after is your best, preferably tweetable definition of that term. And basically, these are terms that people write entire books on, so it's deliberately impossible. but I'm here for your best take. So the first one I'd love to know is colonialism.
How about the extraction of resources from an empire's periphery?
Love that. There we go. See, this is what we get, the nuggets of gold. This is what conceptual lightning round is all about. Post-colonialism.
Well, that's kind of a mixture of indigenous cultures and colonial cultures, but kind of brokered under just conditions, processes and practices.
Right, right. I hope people are tweeting these out as they're watching. Biblical ethics.
Well, that's kind of two-way street. So there's collections of biblical notions, ideas in the Bible itself, but turning it around to how we might use those, it's a kind of thoughtful integration of the multiplicity of biblical principles.
Oh, that was some good one there. I like that. From the title, political trauma.
I guess people have a basic idea of trauma, and I'm just distinguishing between the personal kind where you might have a life-threatening illness or a car accident and the inherently social or political kind, which arises from, say, ethnic violence or something like that.
Yep, right. And the final one is justice.
Ah, too hard. There's just so many conceptions of justice, like, you know, procedural justice or distributive justice, fair distribution of resources or retributive, you know, just punishment. But I think the overriding biblical one would be restorative justice. So through any of those processes to arrive at a restoration of relationships.
Oh, great. See, we got there in the end. I try to make them really hard, but you sailed through that. If we ever do this again, I'll really have to scratch my noggin as to what terms to throw at you. But that was fantastic. I think it is a perfectly reasonable biblical answer to just be like, leave it there. Like, you know, ask me a question, I guess. That's what Jesus would do. Just tell a story or ask me a question and we should be fine.
Right.
So turning to your book, which I mentioned before, Political Trauma and Healing, could you give us a little overview to start of what the work is about and one thing you were really hoping that readers would take away from?
I guess the term post-colonial in the title means that I'm having a go at kind of engaging with the colonial legacies, particularly in Australia. It's a very Australian book, but American publisher, and I've gone through and kind of linked it to other international or global perspectives that have analogies with our own. The Bible's got a complex collection of literatures that has mixed legacy for good and for evil. And I'm trying to provide a reading of the Bible's complexity that can still have really constructive and healing potential for churches today, but beyond churches can encourage Christians to engage more constructively in public space under more kind of humble conditions, without assuming that we're going to tell people what to do, as we might have done in the days of Christendom.
Yeah, that's a great goal to be going for. And I really have been appreciating the Australian context and the deeply rooted Australian examples that get cited. I mean, so many books you read, you know, just because of the nature of the industry, come from America. And so there's this, they're great examples and they're great, theory, but it's like, then you have to do this like kind of step to apply to our context. And so starting with that, and there are still plenty of international examples. So, I mean, anywhere you're reading this, you'll appreciate it and take something away. But I have just been appreciating the Australian stuff.
Yeah, there's a kind of tradition when white people do theology in Australia that they keep tipping the hat to Europe and America.
Mm.
And I think we've got to stop doing that.
There you go. I think that's a good lesson, yeah. Okay, so looking at the book more specifically now, on page 27, for those following at home, you write about how post-colonial theology might contribute to secular democratic conversations in a way that involves both repentance of collusion with colonialism and resistance to new temptations to exercise mastery over others, even if that comes from a democratic majority. I was wondering if you could expand just a little on this to begin with.
Well, I think we've got to acknowledge the legacies of the Christian tradition and not sort of thoughtlessly trade on them. So as a matter of fact, I know a lot of Christians feel anxious and hemmed in here in Australia, Britain, and particularly in America, But I think we've got to get over it because we still have the Democratic majority, even if our majority is still only, I don't know, 60% instead of 70% now. We're still the majority. So we've got some ferocious antagonism in Australia arising from a more militant secularism in the sense of anti-religious secularism. There's also a multi-religious secularism, and we need to engage more humbly with that mix without presuming we need to tell people what to do. And in the public space, that means finding collaborators, finding some common ground with other religious traditions and other ethical traditions, where we can work together to overcome the legacies of colonialism and other sorts of problems which are kind of notoriously in the press from week to week.
Mm. Yeah, well, one of the things I was thinking about that following this thread is, so this semester with our groups at uni, we're exploring reconciliation as a broad theme for the semester. And I was wondering how these post-colonial contributions would play out, for instance, in the conversation around the Australian reconciliation efforts. You write later in the book that it is not difficult to find reasons why reconciliation might be regarded as a hollow discourse in the public domain. So how can this kind of approach help address that and counter that hollowness?
Mm. Well, I was there down in Fed Square in Melbourne when Kevin Rudd did his apology, and it was a very moving people. I was with Aboriginal people. I was working with an Aboriginal organisation at the time. But what followed didn't seem to be consistent over the next years, didn't seem to be consistent with that apology. Mm-hmm. So substantial political theory of reconciliation has got to bring some depths and alternative perspectives rather than just apology. That's a public apology, particularly from a government, can be extraordinarily significant. But then that government needs to follow through with things like reparations and restoration of culturally significant land and the establishment of just institutions so that people can feel appropriately represented if they've been displaced and marginalised for wrongful reasons, such as the wrongful assertion of British sovereignty in Australia. Then we need to find institutions where the rightful acknowledgement of those historic injustices can be brought to bear in, say, a parliamentary process or the consultation processes of local government and the proper acknowledgement of Aboriginal organisations in ongoing political life and so on. Mm-hmm. And churches have a role in that, but it's a larger public conversation that we within the churches need to participate in.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Early in the book, you indicate your reading of scripture as a, quote, a series of socially embodied arguments rather than a single meta-narrative. I'm very excited about that phrase. I'd love to be able to work it into a dinner conversation and know what it means. So if you could just expand on that a little more for me and for us. I shouldn't say this is all for me. For everyone, guys, this is why I'm doing it. And how it may fit with post-colonial theology more broadly.
Okay, so I guess if you're having a dinner party with philosophers, they would know that term, meta-narrative, and they would know that one of the famous definitions of postmodernism includes a kind of doubt or incredulity towards meta-narrative. What's meta-narrative? It's the big story that swallows up all the small stories. So there is a conception of the Christian gospel that sees it as one big story that's capable of swallowing up all the other small stories. And that's a very unfortunately imperialist way of understanding the Bible. And when I read the details of the different strands of tradition and conversations in the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, it strikes me that single meta-narrative approach is an oversimplification of rather more complex conversations that are happening within the Hebrew Bible. There are streams of a kind of national tradition, but there are international traditions as well, and you can have a priestly theology that still acknowledges the possibility that every human being is made in the image of Elohim, and that's an interesting choice of words. It's that generic word like divinity in English, as opposed to the Lord, capital letters Yahweh, the name of Israel's national God. So even a priestly theologian is able to envisage a universal human solidarity, and to acknowledge that the way that God is named might be different depending on which tradition you sit within. So, I could go on. Maybe ask me another question and I'll develop that particular tradition in a particular way.
Yeah, sure. Well, kind of moving into, again, with the post-colonial critiques, in the first section you draw attention to post-colonial critiques of human rights, particularly individualized human rights. At the end of the chapter, Limits and Possibilities of Secular Theology, you offer a Christian understanding of human rights as something that, quote, provokes agape into an ever-widening kenotic embodiment of intercultural communion. Yeah. Another great phrase. What are some of these critiques post-colonialism lays at the feet of human rights? And how might this Christian understanding act as a response to these critiques?
Okay, so there are some classic post-colonial critiques of the kind of manipulation of human rights, of course, which is really a kind of mask for American interests and American political ideas that they might want to implant in other contexts. I say American, but that might be British ideals. There's a strong, diverse Indian literature, as in from the country of India, that resists some of the human rights discourse, even from the English kind of theoreticians. And yet Indian democracy borrowed in part from those English ideals, but they basically said, that's a great idea, but you didn't really live up to it. So you talk vaguely about human equality, but you manage to leave out all sorts of ethnic groups. So on Indian soil, Western ideals of democracy grew into a more kind of mature and more inclusive kind of articulation. And the same thing happened in America, of course. You know, this inspiring American Declaration of Independence that could talk about God-given human rights, but then managed to leave out black people and women. So in the course of time, the prejudices that are laid down in human rights philosophy have been uncovered in various contexts by various, you know, in different generations, where we're rethinking the significance of these ideas of human rights. So trying to avoid the cultural impositions, ethnocentric impositions, or gendered impositions, which people just didn't notice. So you need to debate in particular contexts the unintended consequences of talking about human rights. And one of the most significant ones in our context is the assumption that human rights are primarily individual, whereas Aboriginal societies are collectivists and more inherently social. So the idea of cultural rights and social rights need to be articulated and given the same kind of weight. And kind of legal implications have to be teased out in a different way to embrace those social dimensions. So collective rights for land holding, collective rights for holding natural resources. These are things that Western human rights have often not been able to grasp, although in recent years, particularly in South Africa, where the legal minds have been working at this after apartheid went down, they have been finding legal instruments to recognise collective rights, traditional Indigenous knowledge and so on. And those sorts of analogies from our South African context could apply in our context in all sorts of ways, which I think we haven't yet achieved.
Yeah, well, thank you. Another thing you write is that the church is called to embody the integration of justice and love, agape, in ever-expanding networks of relationships across national and cultural traditions, caring for those in need, whether they're inside or outside of the Christian community. Again, that's a lovely picture. I was wondering whether you had a story or example of a community where you've seen this kind of thing lived out.
I can't give particular names, but there are churches in Melbourne which I have experienced in their common life. They're able to embrace Muslim community members in various ways, either within the heart of church life, where people are trying to articulate their faith in Jesus from a Muslim perspective, or more broadly in support for people who continue to identify more kind of unapologetically as Muslims. So that kind of rich embrace of people without worrying whether they have converted in a conventional sense or not, remain with their Muslim identity, that's something I've seen firsthand in Melbourne. But to me, one of the most dramatic, inspirational stories is being played out as we speak in Lebanon, where a country that has 1 in 4 of its population as a refugee. I get regular emails from Lebanon, from the Baptist College there, and from some of the other organisations, from the churches who are supporting population more generally. And there's not this sense that you sometimes hear in the media that people are kind of trying to sort out whether they're Christian or Muslim. They're just refugees from Syria, overwhelmingly from Syria. So just imagine if Melbourne, a quarter of Melbourne's population were refugees and half of them were Muslim, then you're getting close to what the everyday lived reality of my Baptist colleagues in Lebanon are living with.
Yeah.
I think that's inspirational.
Yeah, no, that is great. It's great to hear that. And that, yeah, where so much of the narrative we hear about refugees is determining, you know, what religious background should we prioritise, and namely that which matches the democratic majority. It's encouraging to hear our stories that are challenging that. So a generalised idea I kind of think I tend to hear like thrown around a bit when people make a distinction between Israel and the church, kind of thing, like what Israel was in the Old Testament and then what the church is in the New, is kind of like this idea that Israel, that was like the internally focused, it was about taking care of your own, and then the church comes along and they were concerned about taking care of everyone, and it didn't matter, you know, it was a universalized, non-ethnic kind of thing. So it's this kind of nationally focused versus universally focused. Now, in the book, you explore the contested nature of this ethnocentrism in Israel itself. So how might your exploration of the Hebrew scriptures challenge or problematize this kind of general distinction?
Well, I think it's pretty clear when you study the Hebrew Bible, Old Testament in any detail, you can see that there's an ongoing tension between a more national focus and a more international scope. And you can find that in many layers of the tradition, many of the different biblical books. And a book like Job is entirely about a foreigner who's very wise and has wonderful ethics and so on. So that's written in Hebrew for a Jewish audience and saying, look, consider this person, Job. He's actually an extraordinarily exemplary human being who can arrive at these wonderful ethics, much like our own, in terms of social justice, on the basis of relating to a creator whose name is nothing like our national name, doesn't have our national covenant, et cetera, et cetera. So that's Old Testament theology, Hebrew Bible theology. So the church builds on a more kind of particularly Pauline ideal of intercultural relationships. And that ideal is wonderful, and I've actually seen it face-to-face on many occasions. But the history of the Christian church has been, against its theory and theology, repeatedly ethnocentric. And you can still go to churches all over Melbourne, all over Sydney, and you'll find that the vast majority of the people there are of the same ethnic group. So in practice, many churches are ethnocentric, even though their theological theory suggests that they shouldn't be. So I think there are kind of particularist and universalist tendencies both in the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament and in the synagogues and in the churches, and these tensions need to be worked out case by case. You know, look at the particular examples of lived experience rather than theorise generally about an ethnocentric Old Testament and a more universalistic New Testament, which doesn't actually prove to be true on closer inspection.
Yeah, great. I think that, like, that's important to problematise a lot of those distinctions. Like, you know, the classic is like the works grace kind of one, as if grace was a concept that only emerges in the first century of the Common Era kind of thing. Yeah
exactly.
In the final section of your book, you engaging the present, You explore four different topics: reconciliation and sovereignty, migration, ecology, and economics and redemption. An effort that runs through all four chapters is the use of both post-colonial readings of the Hebrew scriptures and engagements with Indigenous knowledge. Could you expand on this method a little, what drew you to it, and how it influenced your insights into these complex and vital issues of our time?
Okay. So I guess one of the characteristic errors of colonial theology was a blindness to Indigenous knowledge and a tendency to demonise it as simply pagan and so on. And in the course of the history of colonial Christianity and colonial government, Indigenous knowledge was left to one side. And that was actually, in hindsight, looking back, we can see that there were both theological and kind of political economic errors made when that happened. There is so much in Indigenous knowledge about, for example, our relationship with the natural world, which in ecological theology these days we are rediscovering, and environmental science is discovering the wealth of knowledge about biodiversity and bioregions all across the planet by re-engaging with traditional knowledge where it's still held by elders and so on. And I mentioned the example in South Africa. There are all sorts of commercially exploited traditional knowledges, which people are discovering. They knew that a few thousand years ago, and if we'd only listened to them when we arrived, we might have been able to arrange these the use of these resources on a much more fair and just basis. So that's the kind of South African example in the kind of commercial exploitation of traditional knowledge. But in Australia, traditional knowledge is also related to things like fire management across the continent. So our climate conditions have changed so dramatically that some of that traditional knowledge can't be applied perhaps in the same way as it might have been a couple of hundred years ago. But there are all sorts of resources there that we need careful, detailed conversation with elders to work through. What is it that they know about this place that Anglo eyes have overlooked? And we're trying to repent of that. So I've had some experience of how that works out in political and economic dialogue about the rights of traditional owners in Victoria under native title legislation and discussions about land rights and the use of natural resources and so on. But there are direct analogies with how we should think about, if you like, spiritual resources. The spirituality of traditional Aboriginal Australia has remarkable things to contribute to a church that has been kind of emptied out of its collectivist and social norms and reduced to a kind of individualist kind of spirituality, or the one that is during the week, an individualist one. On Sundays you get together with another bunch of people for that kind of marginal spiritual space on the edges of real life. So that's something that Aboriginal spirituality can actually call us back to rethink. What about the everyday reality of the use of natural resources? Isn't there a spiritual dimension to that? And the answer is yes. What about the everyday experience of going to work? Isn't there a spiritual dimension to that? So the best kind of theological reflection, of course, is breadth. But a lot of our kind of habitual practice has these ethnocentric ways of reducing spiritual reality in a way that Aboriginal spirituality just doesn't do. So I'm constantly encouraged by my Aboriginal friends and Aboriginal Christian friends who combine their traditional knowledge and their Christian identity in ways that I find constantly inspiring. So where historically colonial theology has left Aboriginal voices out of view, I think as a matter of theological method, you should turn that around and start with Aboriginal voices. And then bring in the larger conversation of the biblical and Christian tradition into mm-hmm. its Christian identity, never leaving out our voices, because you do so at your own peril.
Yeah. How would you, like, so you've had experience working with communities, working with policy groups in this area, you know, being in the academy, that there are, what, how would you recommend others begin with these voices if they're starting to think about, you know, a minister starting to think about their Sunday sermon, or just a Christian, a church starting to think about how they read scripture? How do you recommend they, how do you, what are some guides for how to do this process?
Yeah, well, I think one basic thing to do is to work out whose traditional land your church is sitting on, for example. Who are the traditional owners of the country where you live? Where are the Aboriginal organisations in the country where you live? How do they describe themselves? So we speak generally about Aboriginal people, even Indigenous people, more abstractly. But traditional owners will say, no, I'm Wurundjeri or Tunurong or Gunditjmara or Gunaikurnai or whatever it is. They're very specific names which many white people feel like they don't really need to bother with. That's too particular. I think you ought to. You ought to ask, who are these people? Where is their traditional country? Who are their elders? What stories do they have to tell? And from there, more kind of complex questions arise. How did your church property arrive in your possession? In most cases, there are considerable amounts of church property that are that were historically gifts of the Crown, and yet the Crown has not taken that land by a legitimate process. So we have an historic debt to pay, and finding ways to repay for those that land that was wrongly taken in the first place, historically, it's a very complex process, and it requires getting to know your local traditional owners and the other Aboriginal organisations that might be able to help you think through those things. And along the way, Christians probably will need to talk to Aboriginal Christians about how they have dealt with those very questions, because there are many Aboriginal Christians who live on their own traditional land, but there are other Aboriginal Christians who live, say, in urban contexts away from their traditional land, or they belong to stolen generations and their lineage is complex and unclear and so forth. And they've had to go through all these questions. So learning from Aboriginal Christians how to address these historic injustices and so forth, that's part of our task as well. And, of course, the Australian demographic means that that's a very small number of people in terms of percentages, and there's lots of Asian immigration and other kinds of multicultural communities that we need to deal with. But I think it's a question of getting our, you know, the first questions dealt with first, mm-hmm. and then expanding outwards. And there are lots of biblical resources to help us think this through, and people who have been trying to rethink the misuse of the Bible in the history of colonial Christianity. There's no shortage of resources there if you have a will to put issues through.
Yeah, that's really good. I was remembering when talking about listening to Aboriginal Christian people who are living on lands that might not be their own. We chatted to Brooke Prentice a little while ago, and she talked about the kind of dilemma she felt when buying a home on a land that wasn't her traditional land. You know, she was from a different people, and what went on there. And yeah, it was a really great lesson that we'll discuss that further going forward. Yeah. I'm just wondering, just staying with this thread just a little bit, what have, like, you know, from some of those basic levels, what have been some of the things that, like, how you've been able to look at the Hebrew Bible anew from learning from these voices who were colonized, rather than, like, you know, we tend to read, well, we can't avoid me speaking of myself, reading it through the eyes of someone who was part of the colonizing, and so you put that on, but that situation is often very different to a lot of the stories in the Hebrew Bible. What have been some of the, what are some of those key, you know, illuminations when you read it from the underside, from the other side of the imperial colonial engagement?
Well, I've had particular friends over the years, senior Aboriginal people who have been able to say, oh, you know that story about Naboth's vineyard? that's kind of like ours. There's a king trying to take traditional land, and the traditional owner says, no, no, far be it from me that I give up the inheritance of my ancestors. And just really basic questions about who do you identify in that story will illuminate the fact that Aboriginal people feel like they're more like Naboth than the Israelite king. And that helps you reorientate yourself into the narrative in ways that don't presume that you're just basically like an Israelite or a new Israelite, and you can read from the point of view of Israel. Well, no, we're Gentiles. We need to read the story from the point of view of Gentiles. And the ways in which these different perspectives can help open up the biblical narrative have, for me, very often been provoked by conversations with Aboriginal people. I remember having the first time I met Ginny and Ngondara, I was up there in Darwin at a Native Title conference, and a close friend of mine introduced me to him, and we sat and contemplated the ocean there, and he just said things like, "Ah, well, you know that story about Moses? That's an interesting story as an Aboriginal person. You know, he was able to engage with those Egyptian people. He even had an Egyptian name, Moshe. But actually, he was always on the lookout for how to save his people." That's a perspective on the Moses story that I never expected to come from an Aboriginal person. So just sitting down and listening, I have never seen the Moses story in quite the same way again. If you don't have those conversations, you don't have the gift. You won't have those gifts, those fresh perspectives that that these Aboriginal people will bring to us. So there are hundreds of stories like that. But I have to say that as an Old Testament scholar, Hebrew Bible scholar, I've found over the years that I've also had to dig deep into historical studies and not stay with the surface of biblical narrative, because there are some problems, some issues, how we understand the text that really can't be resolved unless you've got a sense of where those texts come from. For example, there are laws about genocide in Deuteronomy. Where do they come from historically? I think it's really important to work that out, the conditions under which those laws arise. And now I'm very convinced that they come from a context in which Israel is engaged with the Assyrian Empire and its threatening kind of presence there to the north. And it's an engagement with that imperial discourse that you find played out in the book of Deuteronomy, often in very uncomfortable ways. Mm-hmm. But I think getting a handle on those historical dynamics essential, and that just takes some study.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, grand awesome. So if you want to study, check out Whitley College and Mark's courses to the University of Divinity. I'm a University of Divinity student myself. No, yeah, you know. And I study it just around the corner at Pilgrim. So if they find out that I'm shilling for Whitley, I'll get in a lot of trouble. But no. University of Divinity is great.
I have some good friends down there. It's okay.
Yeah, that's good. Love this collegiality. So maybe a final question. In your chapter on economics and redemption, you often offer a personal aside about your work with an Aboriginal representative body on native title policy and the reconstruction of traditional economies. I also know that Whitley College, where you teach, has a focus on Indigenous engagement and intercultural studies. You've already touched on this a bit, but what's been your experience working in these areas and coming out of these experiences and the conversations? What are some of the things you'd love churches to be considering around their resources, their economies, and their communities? You mentioned before about how your church got to be on the land that it is. But yeah, what are some other things that have come from this experience and this work?
I think we've got some basic church history to learn and to internalise. For example, historic Christianity right up to the Reformation basically thought that charging of interest was sinful. From the Reformation onwards, there are various alternatives imagined. Already in late medieval Catholic economic theology, there were models of sharing risk in investment and so forth. So they were starting to think about more complex economic ethics from a Christian point of view. But basically, we have blessed capitalism in ways that no biblical or classical Christian author would have thought possible. And that takes some historical and theological work to get ourselves out of. So the capacity for global capitalism to exploit the poor, and these days it's much easier to do because we don't have to look at them when they're being paid terrible wages in India or China even, or places where they're far from view, but the inequities of their financial arrangements and economic arrangements, you know, support us being able to make cheap purchases down the road at Target or whatever, without those things being brought to view. So, yeah, I think it's really important for us as a church to think through the economic practices of our everyday lives and to see those matters as spiritual matters and not as merely material matters. Yeah, there's various ways we could unpack that, but I think we have a kind of thoughtless economic pattern of living which churches need to resist. And you can see really excellent examples, for example, in the perhaps the Uniting Church, their justice advocacy officers are talking about tax and fair trade and so forth. There's some great Baptist thinkers in that area as well. The Not For Sale international campaign, for example. Tim Costello is a great public exponent of fairer practices in economic spheres of life. There are just so many layers to this. Just bringing things to the surface takes some historical awareness and theological sensitivity. And, I think, you know, local churches need to think about what financial contributions they might need to make to Aboriginal organisations as a way of making good, as a way of sort of providing some reparations for the sins of the fathers, as it were.
Mm.
I'm not sure that I can unpack that any further unless you've got some specific examples you want to go into a little further. I teach a class. I have taught a class a few times at Pilgrim, or it was UFT at that point, United Faculty at that point, called Economics, Justice and Theology. And we've looked at Old Testament economic practice, New Testament, the history of Christian ethics and some of the various theological engagements with economic models today. And that's a complex area, but it's not studied as much as it should be. But I think the integrity of the Christian witness requires us to think these things through. Otherwise, we just collapse into the dominant culture. And what makes us particular is basically just what we do on Sundays when we go to church. That's what makes us stand out. Well, that's not really good enough.
Yeah, I think that's a really good challenge. I think economics and capitalism, it gets ignored a lot because it's just... well, that's just the air we breathe, and it's hard to imagine anything else. But it affects. It's the kind of the lens through which all so many other issues hang. We had another talk we had where someone was pointing out just the way we can't even read the parables of Jesus outside of a kind of capitalist lens. Like, and someone did a reading of the parable of the talents, which, you know, about this hard master trying to make as much interest and much money off little things as possible, and like totally owns that. I'm a hard and, you know, unscrupulous man or whatever it is, the thing. And like, we're like, oh, that master must be good because he's trying to make money, and that's what we are meant to be doing.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's a wonderful example. You should have earned interest. And then we think somehow that character might stand for God in some way. Mm. No, not possible. Not possible. The original telling of that narrative, everybody would have known the charging of interest was sinful. There was Mosaic law against it. So when he says you should have charged, you know, earned interest, he was recommending something that was unthinkable to the followers of Jesus who knew those Jewish laws. Mm. They knew that that was wrong. So they couldn't read the parable that way.
Yeah, I think so. That's, as you say, the reason we need to be examining the historical and the what's going on behind the text is, yeah, and so we can start to, you know, really look anew at the systems and structures that we're a part of and asking if they, yeah.
I should also clarify that I'm not a fundamentalist in the sense that, oh, we need to go back to biblical economic models, never charge interest and possibly have slaves and so on.
Right, yeah.
we need to think through the implications of those biblical models for how we structure our economic life today. And if, I think Calvin, John Calvin in Reformation times was sifting competing visions. Do we want a slave-based society or do we want to have loans? On balance, we probably prefer to have loans than a slave-based society. How are we going to make that equitable? How are we going to make that fair? Well, one thing you might do is make sure that the lender doesn't have exploitative regulations on their sides, that you might, you know, share risk, for example, which was a classical Christian economic theological idea. But these days, that idea of sharing risk is virtually unheard of. Sorry, I'm generalising, but it's not that we can just take biblical economic models and immediately apply them, but our economic ethical imagination has to be expanded by the basic concerns that are expressed there in the biblical material, and we need to bring those to our economic arrangements so that we work through what is more fair and less fair, what would lead to more distributive justice, what would lead to more kind of restorative social models of well-being that really enrich the common good, rather than thinking that economics you just do that in the way the dominant culture suggests, and then you give your money to build your church or give your money to your overseas missions, and we've dealt with all those economic dimensions in Christian faith, and there's no problems left over.
Mm.
No, there's some problems left over that we need to deal with.
Yeah, and as you say, there are enormous resources there. You know, I did some work on, like, you know, like reparations through, like, you know, the Hebrew scriptures, like, you know, like kind of in Leviticus, like, you know, guilt offerings and, like, you know, making financially right with the person you've wronged before you can get right with God and Jubilee. And these traditions are there, which, yeah, but because we are so embedded in this system, and one of the really wise things that were pointed out to me was, like, no one, even like the great, you know, people who make films, no one can really envision a world that's not capitalist. Like, whenever any movie set in the future is either capitalist or an apocalyptic wasteland. It's either, like, it's still capitalist or it's all destroyed. Like, there's no, like, it's such a, you know, we might be able to imagine a world without, you know, racism. We might be able to imagine a world without sexism or a world where ecology is back in normal. But the capitalism one seems very hard to shake.
Yeah.
So it seems like good prophetic work to be doing in your churches, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you very much for joining us today. People, I cannot recommend this highly enough. It's really great. It's got biblical reflections. It's got these engaging the present sections, which tackle a lot of really interesting issues. Great discussion on democracy and the way and justice in colonial times. It's a really excellent work. So I definitely recommend checking that out. Mark, are there other ways people can connect with you or connect with your work?
Sure. We do quite a bit of teaching online. So, for example, this semester I'm teaching a class, Will Justice and the Prophets, and there are people in other states that are able to do that. You know, we have MP3s of sound files for the lectures and reading online and so forth. So you don't have to live in Melbourne in order to study at Whitley. So I'll just give a little blurb like that. But there are also conference opportunities. I tend to kind of facilitate conferences most years where we have Aboriginal people come to Melbourne to speak. And this coming July, we've got some Native American theologians coming in and teaching the Bible and theology through Indigenous lenses. So we try to make those kinds of opportunities available to people through Whitley's teaching and learning programs.
Oh, excellent. If people want to find out more about that conference, would they just Whitley's website, would that have info? Or?
Whitley's website, yeah. So there's a mission studies conference called Reimagining Home, and there's some Indigenous streams within that. And then there's the Native American theologians who are delivering three intensive units of study around the same time. And we're also engaging in consultation with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander organisations in early July as well. So there's a lot of stuff happening early July.
That's exciting. So, people, if you've got some professional development you need to do, or you want to go on a retreat, like this is the time. Check out Melbourne down in July and get along to that. Well, Professor Mark Brett, thank you very much for joining us today and sharing with us your insight and wisdom. And look forward to connecting with you, and look forward to discussing this in groups, everyone.
Thanks. Great. Thank you, Lynn. Bye.
Thank you again to Mark Brett. I encourage you all to go check out his book, Political Trauma and Healing. Thanks for all who've been tuning in. Keep sharing the word around. Follow us at Rinse Repeat Pod, or me at Liam Miller 87. Check us out at loverinserepeat.com. And thanks again to PhysX, who continues to provide the music. I mean, it's all the same song, but still, thanks. All right, see you everyone later. Bye.